Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who explains why he believes progressive gains in the U.S. Senate in the November 7th election could change the political environment in Washington. Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign, who discusses the record-breaking amounts of money spent in this year's election campaign and the urgency of enacting reforms in overturning the Supreme Court's Citizen United ruling. And author Joy Gordon, a professor of law and philosophy at Fairfield University, who examines the effect of economic sanctions on the civilian population of Iran. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
It's been a year since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched his comeback after serving 4 years as prime minister. Putin is now taking a tougher line, sparking new protests by Russia's emerging middle class, tired of corruption and autocratic rule. Putin is blocking reforms and forging a new alliance with the Russian Orthodox Church, reports the Christian Science Monitor. A minor anti-Putin protest in a near-empty church turned into an international incident as a Russian court sentenced the banned Pussy Riot to 2 years in jail. New legislation in the Russian parliament, or Duma, could criminalize religious blasphemy for the first time since the 19th century. Meanwhile, Russia's opposition, which has mobilized tens of thousands of people, is establishing its own alternative culture in clubs and on radio and TV stations. An opposition coordinating council plans to endorse political candidates, support political prisoners, and call attention to corruption in the Kremlin. But Putin is returning to his previous KGB police tactics to retain control. Several prominent dissident politicians are being investigated, while a member of parliament has been stripped of his power and immunity, and a parliamentary aide has been arrested. During the worst years of the Great Recession, when homeowners most needed the savings they could have received by refinancing at lower interest rates, Freddie Mac helped keep millions of borrowers locked in high-interest rate mortgages. ProPublica reports that Freddie Mac, the taxpayer-owned mortgage giant, resisted signing on to the Obama administration's mortgage refinancing programs out of fear it would cut into its own profits. Opposition to the proposals made in the early days of the Obama administration were led by two Republican-nominated board members, Robert Glauber and Linda Bammann, along with the chief risk officer, Paige Wisdom. Their resistance made it harder for millions of Americans to refinance their high-interest rate mortgages. According to ProPublica, Glauber and Bammann also opposed the Obama refinancing policy because they considered it to be a backdoor economic stimulus. Columbia University housing economist Christopher Mayer estimates that a more aggressive government-backed refinancing program implemented by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae would have helped an additional 9 million homeowners save $75 billion in interest payments and would have prevented hundreds of thousands of delinquencies and foreclosures. ProPublica points out that Freddie and Fannie, that own or back about 60% of all U.S. home mortgages, have a mandate to help expand home ownership while at the same time generating profits, two competing goals which constitute a conflict of interest. For the second time, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, was overturned by a federal appeals court as discriminatory toward gays and lesbians. The fate of DOMA may soon rest with the United States Supreme Court. In mid-October, the Second District Federal Court of Appeals in New York overturned DOMA in a case involving New York City resident Edith Windsor, who married her longtime partner Clara Spire in Canada in 2007. 2 years later, Spire died. Because of DOMA, Windsor faced a $363,000 tax bill from the Internal Revenue Service as she was not considered a surviving spouse. In late May, the Boston Federal Appeals Court also overruled DOMA, affirming a 2010 district court ruling. The decision by federal judge Joseph Toro condemned DOMA's two classes of benefits, one for opposite-sex married couples and another for same-sex couples. Former Justice Department official Gregory Katsas says it's unlikely the current Supreme Court, under the leadership of Chief Justice John Roberts, will strike down a federal statute passed by a strong majority in Congress and signed by President Bill Clinton. Supreme Court watchers say that Justice Anthony Kennedy will likely be the swing vote on DOMA in the divided court. And the case could be further complicated if Justice Elena Kagan recuses herself due to the role she played in cases involving DOMA when she was U.S. Solicitor General. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
With victories in a majority of critical swing states across the country, President Obama was reelected to a second term on November 7th. Control of both the House of Representatives and Senate remained unchanged, with Republicans holding onto the House, despite the loss of several extreme right-wing Tea Party candidates, and Senate Democrats picking up seats in Massachusetts and Indiana. Democratic Senate candidates elected or reelected in hard-fought campaigns November 7th included Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Tim Kaine of Virginia, and Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. Progressive Independent Senator Bernie Sanders won an overwhelming victory in Vermont. The Democrats held on to power in the White House and Senate despite a coordinated Republican effort to put in place restrictive voter ID laws, limiting early voting, and curtailing voter registration that targeted Democratic-leaning voters. The election came a week after monster Hurricane Sandy visited destruction in New York City and across the Northeast, highlighting the critical importance of government emergency assistance during times of natural disasters, a moment that many pundits maintained gave a last-minute boost to the president. Your reporter spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who explains why he believes progressive gains in the U.S. Senate could change the political environment in Washington and describes the battles ahead over the future of Social Security and Medicare.
I happen to have a lot of objections to President Obama's stance on the issues, in many areas where we disagree. But the bottom line is that he's winning against conservatism. And that's significant. It, in and of itself, even though it's a status quo election, it's an election where I think the American right thought after 2010 it was on in the march. Mm. They were just going to take the presidency and be done with it. That hasn't happened. So that's number one. Number two, I think a very important thing is happening with the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate is going to be a decidedly more left-wing chamber than it was in this most recent two-year cycle. I'll give you a very good example. Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren coming in, replacing Scott Brown, obviously a more progressive player. Even in Maine, Angus King, no lefty, but on a host of issues, Affordable Care Act, a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, and a variety of other issues, way better than Olympia Snow. And then let's start moving into some really interesting stuff. Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin, going to win that seat. Tammy Baldwin has voted steadily with Bernie Sanders on most issues, replacing a very moderate Democrat in her poll. Indiana, Congressman Donnelly coming into that seat. He's no big lefty, but on labor and economic issues, he's voted very, very strongly with the AFL-CIO, much better than his predecessor, Richard Lugar. We can keep moving across the map. People like Sherrod Brown, reelected. Bernie Sanders, obviously, reelected. When you add it all up, it will still be a Democratic-controlled chamber, but the Democrats in it will be decidedly more progressive than the people who served before them. And even take one final look at the state of Connecticut. Murphy may not be the greatest left-winger in history, but I think he's going to be a decidedly better player in the Senate than Joe Lieberman. What I'm saying is that that is significant when you put that there, because the first thing that the U.S. Senate needs to do, I was interviewing Bernie Sanders about this just the other day, first thing that the U.S. Senate has to do is reorganize itself, and it needs to do filibuster reform. And you couldn't do that when you had a Joe Lieberman and some of these other players there because they were too inclined to work with the Republicans to block it. Now, Harry Reid, to my read, is going to have a Senate where he can actually start to talk about serious filibuster reform. That puts a lot more power on the progressive side than what you had before.
Do you see progressive activists rising up in an Obama second term to pressure him like they did not do in the first term to pursue a more progressive agenda, given the fact that there's a lot of criticism of Obama and his leadership on some key issues from the left in the country.
Tonight I've been with Marcy Kaptur, the congresswoman from Northwest Ohio, opponent of the war in Iraq, a very, very strong economic populist, one of the people who voted against the bank bailout because she didn't want to bail out big banks. And she won big with over 70% of the vote. One of the things that she said tonight in her victory speech was, I hope that President Obama takes a look at who reelected him. Because the fact of the matter is, he was reelected by progressives. He was reelected by people who want him to be a more progressive president. They have elected a more progressive Senate, much more progressive than what we had before. They've moved the House a little bit in the proper direction. And so it's clear that progressives have political power in this country. If President Obama does not pay attention, if he chooses to deny the fact that he was reelected by progressives, then progressives have to get into the streets. I mean, the fact is, it doesn't work for progressives merely to protest against horrible Republicans. Because if we have a system where Democratic presidents and governors know that progressives will never go to the mat to challenge them and push them, those Democratic presidents and governors will be, you know, not always, but by and large, inclined toward bending to Wall Street, toward bending to economic and political power.
Given that President Obama has entertained a grand bargain last year with House Speaker John Boehner, and he has made noises that he may be considering such a move again in the final months of his first term to cut back Social Security and trim back Medicaid in exchange for some modest increases in taxes on the wealthy. What's the fight back from progressive forces? Do you see this developing as a major conflict?
Yes, I hope it does. And there's a lot of different touch points and touchstones in this fight. I would make it very, very simple for people. Look at what Bernie Sanders does. Bernie Sanders has made it absolutely clear he intends to fight to the mat on this thing. They have absolutely no cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And Bernie's ready to start fighting tonight. Even in his victory speech, he's talked about these things. There are many new members of the House and the Senate. Voters should go to them immediately and say, we elected you to save Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They should also go to sitting members with the same message. The fact is, if the president tries to do this, progressives should try to drive a wedge between the president and the Democrats in the Senate, especially because they have a majority there, and to make it impossible for him to do it.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine and author of the book Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. For more analysis and commentary on the November 7th election, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As was predicted, the 2012 presidential election campaign broke all records for fundraising, with both the Obama and Romney campaigns collecting about $1 billion each. According to the website Open Secrets, the Romney campaign, the Republican Party, and outside super PACs like Karl Rove's American Crossroads led the campaign cash competition, spending over $989 million. President Obama's campaign and their outside PACs trailed by a little, spending over $928 million. The enormous amount of money in this year's campaign, much of it unaccountable, was made possible by the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United versus FEC case, which lifted restrictions on independent political expenditures. In the closing days of the campaign, the Center for Public Integrity and the Center for Responsive Politics reported that super PACs and secretive nonprofit groups had allocated more than $820 million in independent expenditures in the campaign, with the overwhelming majority of it favoring Republicans and their candidate Mitt Romney. But the U.S. public may never know exactly how much money was spent in the 2012 presidential and congressional elections. Unlike super PACs, regular political action committees, and direct contributions to candidates and party committees, 501c4 groups do not have to report donations or donors. But according to a recent poll commissioned by the Corporate Reform Coalition, Americans of all political backgrounds agree there is way too much corporate money in politics. 9 in 10 Americans, 89%, agree with that statement, and 51% strongly agree. A strong majority of those surveyed believe that corporate money drowns out the voices of average Americans and corrupts our democratic government. Your reporter spoke with Nick Neihardt, president and CEO of the group Public Campaign that supports public funding of election campaigns. Here he talks about the urgency of enacting reforms in overturning the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling.
The campaign finance law has always been full of loopholes, and having a lot of money to spend has always meant greater power than ordinary voters who don't have much money to give to politics. But the Supreme Court opened the door wide open, and Citizens United and several other decisions which basically relaxed regulation of campaign finance to the point right now that there really are no effective laws, and the current law allows a group of individuals or an individual to write as large a check as they want and do that in direct service of a candidate for office. You can't write that big check right to the campaign, but you can write it to an organization that advances that candidate's campaign very directly. The other thing the law did was say to corporations, you don't have to worry about dodging around and finding the loopholes in the law anymore. You can go straight out and directly oppose or support candidates for office without having to give to a side group that does just issue ads, for instance. And they also said by allowing 501c4 organizations to operate more directly in politics, they essentially have said, because that money isn't revealed as to where it comes from, that people can write very large checks, impact elections, and do it anonymously, so you can't even hold them accountable.
Nick, what's new this year in presidential politics in terms of the money that's flowing in that we haven't seen before as a result of Citizens United or other factors? I know that big Chevron check written to the Republican Party in the Romney campaign towards the end of the campaign cycle was somehow crossing a line that hadn't been crossed by these big companies before.
That's right. A lot of the money that's been coming in has been from very wealthy individuals or their private companies that are held by them and their family. So it's almost like dipping into a second bank account when they write a corporate check. What we haven't seen so much is publicly held corporations whose shares are traded openly, where members of the public can own a piece of the company. We haven't seen those companies get involved in a big way, but we just saw a $2.5 million check written from Chevron, the oil giant, to the Republican House Super PAC. So all of a sudden, you have one of these companies jumping in a very direct way, and they simply said, you know, the Republicans favor our policies, so we're going to get behind them and hope for better government. And that's a really scary thing because I'm sure they may be the first to cross that line and give that much, but they won't be the last. And I think we can look forward next year to seeing even more of this behavior where the corporations themselves, the biggest ones in the country, begin to jump in a big way in these elections. It's already been the most expensive election ever with big checks drowning out the voices of ordinary people more than ever before, but it will probably get worse in the next election cycle. We have to change the system to stop that.
Nick, in closing, certainly money in politics in the United States is an issue that is really a keystone for so many other large issues confronting the country. You know, everything from energy policy to defense spending to climate change to reproductive rights. Almost everything under the sun in politics is affected by the amounts of dollars flowing to the politicians. So maybe as we say goodnight, you can speak to the importance of this issue, not just for the ethics of politics and controlling the money, but for the big issues that many of our listeners are passionate about.
Well, I think we're not going to see the people's will listened to on all those issues as long as you have a government that's of, for, and by the billionaires, the special interests, and the biggest corporations. We have a notion in this country that democracy is all about a government that's of, by, and for the people. We won't have that until we deal with this. We won't have it on basic budget issues, what the government spends money on tax issues, on the future of energy, whether we're going to go to continue down an unsustainable path or whether we're going to invest in sustainable energy and make it available to everybody. You go issue after issue. Who gets cared for and who doesn't with health care? Whether we have privatized schools or public schools, but every single issue you can think of where there is money to be made, there's a special interest willing to fund a politician to advance that issue. So unless we solve this problem, the problems that we're dealing with, the larger problems in our society, are going to get bigger and bigger. I do have faith that most Americans will rally around the notion that we want a government of, by, and for the people, and that ultimately we're going to win. The real question is how long and how many mistakes our government will make due to listening to deep-pocket interests before we can win a victory on this. But it is the fight of our times.
That was Nick Neihardt, president and CEO of the Group Public Campaign. Find more information on groups advocating campaign finance reform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the 2012 election campaign, both President Obama and his challenger Mitt Romney called for ever tougher sanctions on Iran in an effort to prevent that country from developing a nuclear weapon. For the record, Iran denies it's seeking a weapon, maintaining it is working to develop nuclear power for civilian purposes only. Unilateral U.S. sanctions have been layered on those imposed by the United Nations, the European Union, and other governments. The multifaceted economic embargo is making life continually harder for ordinary Iranians, much as the decade-long sanctions against Iraq from the end of the First Persian Gulf War to the 2003 U.S. invasion impacted the lives of ordinary Iraqis more than that of officials in Saddam Hussein's government. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joy Gordon, a professor of law and philosophy at Fairfield University, who wrote the definitive book on the Iraq sanctions and has followed the situation in Iran closely. Here she discusses how so-called targeted sanctions, designed to focus on the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, have led to life and death consequences for many ordinary Iranians.
The UN sanctions themselves are actually fairly narrow. They're crafted to address nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, and they also have an evidentiary requirement. So, for example, they ask member states to seize cargo of a ship if they have reasonable grounds to believe that the ship contains equipment related to nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles. And that's also true for financial transactions and for transfer of technology and so forth. But what's really doing the great damage in Iran are the unilateral sanctions imposed by primarily the U.S., but also the European Union, Canada, Australia, Japan, and South Korea. Those are just wholesale attacks on Iran's entire ability to function financially, on its energy sector, and on its imports and exports. So whereas the Security Council sanctions require member states to see that their banks don't participate in financial transactions that could contribute to nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles, the U.S. sanctions on the financial networks are entirely different. No bank in the U.S. may transfer any funds to any Iranian bank or to a third bank, which might in turn transfer it to an Iranian bank. No Iranian bank may have a branch in the U.S. The SWIFT network, which is the network that permits banks to transfer funds to another bank in a different country, it's the fundamental machinery for financial transfers internationally. It's the only one of its sort. There's no real workaround. There's no other way to do a financial transfer if you don't use the SWIFT network. And last July, the United States persuaded SWIFT to simply cut out all Iranian banks altogether. So what we're seeing is whole-scale damage to Iran's basic ability to engage in any financial transfers, in any shipping, in any sale of oil, in any development of its energy sector.
I know you had researched extensively the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iraq. Are there that level of impacts on the civilian population in Iran now?
The first sanctions were imposed in 1979, but the Security Council sanctions are much more recent.
Who imposed in 79? You mean U.S.?
U.S., yeah. We see in Iran a redrafting of the sanctions in a way that looks like they're very different from the sanctions on Iraq. The sanctions on Iraq, simply on their face, prohibited Iraq from importing or exporting anything except for very limited exceptions, which were then in turn undermined by the Security Council members individually. In the case of Iran, the sanctions on their face look very narrow and very reasonable. And then what happens is that there are states, the U.S. and others, that then impose their own sanctions. But also what's interesting to me is if you look at the Security Council resolutions closely, they say the member states shall exercise vigilance over shipping, over financial networks, and so on. So they don't say flatly, you should cut Iran off from any financial transaction of any sort. So they just use these terms like exercise vigilance or used enhanced monitoring. But it's unclear what those mean. Those are very vague terms. And so then what happens is the U.S. and the EU and a few other countries then say, we have been called upon by the Security Council to engage in, to exercise vigilance, and here's how we're going to exercise vigilance. We're going to do it by blocking every transaction of every sort through every bank that could ever end up in Iran in any fashion. And we see that now coming about in very absurd extremes. So, for example, in the U.S., Iranian Americans are legally permitted, at least in theory, to send money to their relatives in Iran, and many have for years. They send money to their elderly parents. But even though they're permitted to send these remittances, there is no bank that they can legally send any money through at all, nor can they send it through informal procedures. So the result is that even if this is permitted in principle, in fact, it's not possible. In addition to the actual sanctions themselves, there's a chilling effect that not only are companies abiding by these very extreme measures, but because they are so fearful of prosecution, given how high the penalties are, then they're also erring on the side of not doing anything that might be interpreted as a violation.
That was Joy Gordon, a professor of law and philosophy at Fairfield University. Her book is titled Invisible War: The United States and the Iraq Sanctions. Find more information on the effects of economic sanctions on civilian populations on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.